Succession number 26561, reel 17.
Wing Commander Bernard, reel 17. Now, we're talking about the time when you were in Stalingrad IV from June, approximately June 1943. We looked at how you built the wireless thing. How did life go on? Because you were in there nearly a year and a half, you know, before the Long March. What do you recall of life there and what you did and how it differed from previous camps?
Tedious, really, I think is the word. Apart from the time it took to build the radio. The other thing that I did was to say, in telling the senior British officer what I was offering, I said, "You will take Big X off my back." Big X was the security business, which was if a set of people to warn the Germans coming into the camp and that sort of thing. It was very obvious to the ferrets who knew camp life internally very well.
But can you explain what you mean? We haven't talked about this. You've talked about the duty pilot thing.
Yes.
You said you were going to say what went wrong.
If something clandestine was going on, there were people to warn that either tunnels or whatever was going on. And the German internal securities, the ferrets we called them, couldn't really cope on this. I lost my theme.
You're talking about the ferrets and how our security, the British security.
Yes. So whenever an illegal, from the Jones viewpoint, was taking place, there was a chain of signalers who would either be knocking a pipe out or peeping over the top of a book, and they were really, to my mind, almost signposting where the activity was taking place. And I said, I want it in such a way that there is no indication of an activity taking place. The other thing I used, by the way, if I was working on the radio, the only thing I had was somebody at the end of the corridor who played a significant record as a warning. And this was the flight of the bumblebee. Rimsky-Korsakov's flight of the bumblebee was the signal to shut down. The Germans were coming into the end of the hut.
So you preferred a simple lookout system in the hut?
Inside the hut, because it couldn't, externally, it couldn't see any difference. But if they put that on, we just throw a blanket over everything. And I had the radio either on the top of the top bunk, and the aerial was permanently wound in round the room at top bed level, and my mains connection was subtle and clandestine.
What about searches? Were there many searches?
Yes, many, and frequently at that camp, the Gestapo would come, and I was always out early in the morning to see all the duty people were working, and I spotted a load of several staff cars arrived with what I recognised as Gestapo, because they all wore long coats and black hats, and this team of Gestapo men unloaded. And I was able to go around and to advise the security people in our own security people that are about to search us. And they did that quite frequently, the Gestapo.
And how rigorous was their search?
Oh yes, the usual stuff, you know, pulling everything about, opening up mattresses and that sort of thing.
But they didn't find your wiring or your books?
No.
So, anything else that untoward or to get connected with the routine?
No, we used to play a lot of rugby in the winter there, but parcels were reasonable at that time. But we'd already got plans, and in my mattress I had a rucksack, which was illegal from the German point of view. It was a sugar bag with service braces, trouser braces to hold it up, and extra socks, and in the winter an extra set of pajamas were all bundled together, so that if I had to escape at any time, if the opportunity occurred, we had all this stuff to escape with.
Now, you said you had plans. What do you mean you had plans?
Well, what we would do in the event, or nearer the time that we did get evacuated, we could see there may be problems.
You mean you had plans when it became apparent they might move you?
Yes. And I would say we were watching the front coming towards us, and then we got this signal from the BBC, from Air Ministry, via the BBC, to stay put in the camp.
Now, when was that?
Oh, that would be in 44, wouldn't it? We got that message at the end of 44. So we were planning to do things, how we would operate.
What you're saying is that for that year and a half, nothing much happened?
Nothing much, no. No,
I
just kept the radio services going, and under my own steam. I'd never got known by the Germans. The Germans didn't know what I was up to.
So, when you got the...
They were very keen on the fellow who'd left the wires hanging out of the panel timber. They kept an eye on him, but he was no longer signals officer.
So, when you got the signal from the BBC, that was to stay put?
Yeah.
And that would be about December 44?
Yes, about that time, yeah.
And
it was
so
winter time, anyway, yes. But we still thought there might be something. I think it was the old hands knew that you had to have good boots and warm clothing for if you're going to escape in the winter.
But you weren't actually going to. You'd been told to stay put.
Yes.
So what happened next then?
Well, we then one evening in January, February.
January, but if it's the same time as Stalag 3.
Yes.
So what happened?
Well, we just suddenly came in at about 11, before midnight, just, and said, you're all moving out. And the guards came in, the ferrets came in and said, we've all got to move out.
Now, so you didn't get any notice?
Oh, no.
Were you able to get your rucksack?
Yes, we had enough notice to... Well, this is where the planning took place. We knew that the Germans would be panicking too, because they'd have to take us, they'd have to guard us. And so we had a plan. Our combine of 10 nipped out to the German carpentry shop, because they weren't guarding the wires very well then, and stole a carpenter's outfit and got back in. They knew it was there, saws and hammers and nails, and we cut the top off of a new three-tier bunk, which had good fresh timber in it, and sawed a leading edge on the one strip of the bed. And we put a couple of hockey sticks on the back and a panel on the top. And we all had our rucksacks, which were bundled onto that sledge. And we also got a case of margarine. And we had a suitcase full of cigarettes for bargaining en route. What else did we do? Yes. Oh, we were very careful with our boots. We wore clogs a lot of the time to save our British Army boots, which were heavily studded.
Now, you said they'd stopped guarding the wires so much. What do you mean by that?
Oh, between ourselves and the carpenter's shop in the German guards area.
So it was the interior?
Semi-interior, yes.
How did it show us? I mean, did they not guard it at all? Or what? I mean...
Well, there was no floodlighting on it, and the guards were so busy running around for their departure too that no one was taking any notice of all this going on. And then Alan Morris took over, and these were all squadron leaders and wing commanders and all sorts of people, and the guards were getting machine guns mounted ready to combat any insurgents on their part, and Alan Morris stood up and said, and harangued all these officers and marshalled them into some sense of order, because they were running around like headless hens. But he marshalled them. He was a born leader, a small wonder. He was highly educated, very intelligent, NCO. Well, he was a warrant officer at that time.
So what happened next then?
Well, about just before... It was still dark and snowing when we were assembled and moved out. So I suppose first light... We really had something like 4 or 5 hours to do all this. We built the sledge and put the ropes on and put our rucksacks on it. We all dressed up with, because it was very cold, all the clothing we could get, an extra set of pyjamas, those who had it under the thing, two lots of socks. And the other thing we did is... burgled the German's cookhouse and got a large tray and broke into the storeroom and got margarine and put them in these trays and melted them down. And we all, in turn, with our boots on, got the boots heavily covered with grease for the snow, anti-snow incursion. Now, and then eventually we marched out. Oh, we burgled the Red Cross store and issued everyone with a Red Cross parcel each for the long march. We didn't know it was going to be long, but we needed food. It was very cold.
So what happened? Tell us as you left the camp.
Well, we just moved off with the guards either side, and they had a lot of guards. They had a dog. We're going in rows of threes, three columns to a row, three rows to a column, and the guards every other row had either a dog or a machine gun handler, very well guarded, and we set off with those who'd made illegal rucksacks were wearing them. I, in fact, was so cold, and I had my rugby scrum hat, which was very good for my ears to keep warm.
Now, and you had your wireless with you?
And the wireless was put on the sledge, yes.
So, tell me what happened as the march started.
Oh, I just eventually the whole stream went out. Nobody got shot, thanks to Alan Morris. And incidentally, he got the MBE for all his activities in the prison camp. What else? Can't think of anything else at Valeria. No, we were.
So what happened then?
We just was on the march. We didn't know where we were going. There was no arrangements for food or clothing or accommodation, although in the early days we were going, we went by funny roundabout routes to avoid stopping the trains or traffic. The Germans are retreating. It was a very roundabout route. We didn't know where we were going. The guards didn't know where we were going. And we had no, other than those Red Cross parcels, we had no German issue of food at all.
Now, what was the cold like? What was the weather like?
Oh, dreadful, yes. And the first night, March, we got very cold feet, of course. And some of the newer prisoners because they didn't put two pairs of socks on, had blisters on their heels. And then even more foolish, they cut the leather heel out of their boots and got frostbite in them. And they were in a very poor state.
Was it actually snowing?
Yes, on and off and frozen. And the first night we managed to get into an open-sided barn, but it was bitterly cold, and I'd got some black flying boots which the bottoms had worn off, but I used those as gaiters, and I was foolish enough to take my boots off because my feet were killing me, and I tucked them under my armpits and slept on the straw in this open barn, and it was very cold. Most of us would all huddle together like sardines and self-support each other in the cold. And in the morning I was woken up by a German guard very early with a rifle butt bashing at me, and he said, "Raus, raus," and I fished out my boots, but they'd gone banana shape and frozen at the time. I had to thrust them under my armpits. Meanwhile, I was getting this rifle butt and rouse, rouse. And I told him to bugger off. We didn't tolerate the German guards very well. I had slid these gaiters down over my feet to sleep for the night. But after that, I never took my boots off at all for 3 weeks. And as I say, these foolish ones that had the heels cut out. Anyway, we went via Krakow, and there was a glass factory down there, and that was the best accommodation we had during the march, because being a glass factory, it was very warm. And I got my radio, two-book radio, off the sledge, and set it up because the German guards had gone into the office accommodation and left us in the main place where they were blowing glass. And I got the news, the BBC news from there.
The way it was worth taking.
Oh, yes. And then we went on and on. We kept getting diverted and going a roundabout way again and again. I don't think the Germans, there must have been a sergeant or something in charge of the party. Didn't see any German officers, but they might have been there, I don't know. And then this went on for quite a time. It was an interesting, at one point, we had this case of cigarettes for bargaining for anything en route. And then we came across, well, usually a big
farm. So what would you be bargaining for and with?
Food, anything has.
With who?
With the German populace, the civilians.
Were they willing to barter?
Some were, yeah. Oh, yes, cigarettes were very precious to them, yes. And so we had a suitcase full of them, yes. Anyway, I'll come to the point where we arrive at this big, giant farm. And it was in the shape of a square, a German giant farm. And there was a lot of tanks, German Panzer tanks around it, surrounding this farm. And we discovered the CO was was walking about looking after his tanks, and Alan Morris, I don't know, with his posh German accent, decided to chat him up, and he was a nice character. He got his skull and crossbones on his hand, but that wasn't his nature. Indeed, we discovered, he told us, that he was in fact a medical doctor, not practicing medicine, but the CO of the tank regiment. And we chatted with him, and we told him about the... Oh, incidentally, some of these characters who had the frostbite in their cut-out boots were put on the sledges because they couldn't walk at all at that stage. And we told him about this when we heard he was medical officer. He was chatting with us in German, of course, and Alan could know it precisely. I knew the general gist of it. My German was more rudimentary. And we said, we've got these wounded ones, and if they don't march, they get shot. And he was very concerned, I think, that this was happening to Geneva prisoners of war. And we said to him, he said, I would lend you a lorry and for your non-walking wounded, but I am here because I'm completely out of fuel for my tanks, and my lorries are supporting the tanks. He said, if I had petrol, and Alan and Morris and I said, well, if you give us a guard and our parole, we will get petrol. He said, I'll do better than that, I'll come with you. And he is true to his word. He came with us, and we bargained with a German farmer nearby who had tractors to run and so on. And for a consignment of cigarettes, we got 2 jerry cans of diesel. And he went back and gave us a guard and a lorry for our non-walking wounded.
Was it true they were shooting them?
I didn't know personally of anything, but all the guards knew that they had instructions. If they didn't march, we knew that. The German guards told us that. Whether they would have done it or not, because they were suffering too, just as much as we were, except they had all the prime accommodation and they were able to get food more easily than we were. We would even dig out turnips in a field and that sort of thing.
Well, let's talk about the scavenging for food, then, or foraging, a bit nicer.
Yeah,
foraging. Tell us about that.
Well, the Red Cross parcels ran out, and the first week or so, because we were marching all the time. And an interesting one on that march, too, was and there was a blizzard blowing, and Alan Morris and I were together, and he said, Dave, I've got an idea. He said, this is dreadful. We might do better if we can get into a farmhouse somewhere for accommodation and maybe talk them into giving us some food. So I said, yeah, I'll go for that. So we told the guard we were going to have a wee in the ditch, but it was a blizzard at the time, and he agreed to it, and but was not very well. He was as weary as we were, and we went out, and it would be about mid-afternoon, and we were away for about an hour, distancing ourselves from the column, and we looked down on the farm from this little hill, and we saw sacks moving around, and we turned out that they were Polish girls and sacking clothing, you know, bulked up against the cold because they were working on the land. And we thought it was a calculated risk that we might be able to get some food from them. And that time, remember, I'd been a prisoner for 4 years and hadn't even hardly seen a woman, let alone talk to them. And we talked to them in German because they all, nearly all spoke German. And that night they took us under their wing, And that night we went and we slept with 15 Polish girls. They were delightful, very sympathetic, and the bed was a converted shupan for cattle, which had a long platform, about 30 centimetres off the ground, and covered in straw, no mattresses or anything like that. And we slept soundly in that. We weren't at all interested in is what they'd give us to eat the next morning.
And did they supply any food?
Yes, the next morning was a Sunday, and they were all dressed up in the Polish finery, rather like the Russian garb of high headdresses and colourful blouses and skirts. They were ever so excited, having got a couple of RAF boys to themselves. And they had a cauldron at the end of this ship, and like the old witch's one, and made a giant soup out of that. And then somebody went, pinched some chickens from the farmer and put them in, and took most of the feathers off the thing that went into the soup. And they fed us with chicken soup next day. But we decided that they'd risk being shot if we didn't get out, so we pressed on.
You rejoined the column?
And we rejoined the column.
But were you able to find any food? I mean, that you could take back with you?
Oh, no. They hadn't got it, it wasn't about.
Were you able to rejoin the column where you'd left it, with your friends?
Yeah, because we heard that, they'd all stopped and they were getting hot soup at this other point. All a very ad hoc arrangement.
So they got soup as well. So what happened next?
We went home, we trudged on through the snow, sometimes sleeping. And then we got these chaps to the railhead, by the way, thanks to this German tank CO, and they were put into cattle trucks and knocked off somewhere or other. I didn't know there, because I went on, got as far as Cottbus.
Cock?
Cottpus. Cottbus. And I've recently been through there and recognised briefly what it was, and it was a long march, and we did double that distance because we were going round in loops all the time, weaving, keeping out of the way of the German retreat.
So what happened at Cottbus?
At Cottbus, I was selected out by name and put on another cattle truck and sent to Buchenwald.
Now, by cattle you mean train?
Yeah, train, but not carriages. They were just cattle trucks.
You said another cattle truck, which implied...
Oh, the one lot went on, and I don't know
by
where.
By train?
Cattle truck train.
Now, how, why were you picked out? Who was on this very different
truck?
I mean, because they're going somewhere very different from you. You're going somewhere more ominous as well.
Yes.
How many were picked out?
About three, and I lost them in the car. Three from that party.
Now, were there many people on the train?
That cattle truck wasn't crowded like they normally were. Incidentally, I got my radio and I tore it to bits and fed it through the cracks in the cattle truck to get rid of the evidence. And I had a loaf of bread. I'd been issued by the Germans to... And they cut an indentation in the bottom of this bread, rather like the indentation of a brick. And they put the cutting to one side, hollowed it out, and put all my valuable components, apart from the valves, inside this loaf, and packed the dough around them, and fitted this slab base back on and secured it with some darning needles that I had in my repair kit.
So you conceal what the irreplaceable parts, the valves, the things like that?
The difficult ones. I want a lot of man-hours to make. And the transformer, and the bread was very heavy. Black bread was very heavy, and part sawdust too. And the bottom was covered with sawdust, so when I put the underneath lid back on,